Alex Warren became homeless because his alcoholic and abusive mother kicked him out of the house at the age of 18. He had been living with her since his father's death when he was 9. I mean, what did you do between 9 and 18? You could have got a job. Put that back up there. There's more. Wait. There's more. This led him to sleeping in friends' cars for a while as his mother had convinced their parents he was a troublemaker, according to the BBC.
No, according to ChatGPT. Come on.
All right. Okay. His mother was struggling with alcoholism and had mental health issues. Yeah, she sounds like a chocolate fireplace. All right. Well, nice story. Thank you, Sims. Otherwise, we would never have known about it.
Great story.
Thank you.
Great story.
Ben's going to work on his backstory.
I need a backstory this weekend. I need drama. I need misery.
You need to lose it all. The crux of it is you came from a good family and then you did something to lose it all. And now you're the black sheep of the family. And then this is your time for redemption. That's the story.
There's the thing.
I'm too normal here. I'm never going to be a massive star.
Okay, then you don't want to
then
be
you don't
successful.
Make $1 million off your song.
This is the reality, guys. I know. Yeah.
Make sure you have a job to avoid homelessness and avoid being white or male for greater employment opportunities, Slippery Pickle. Sims is selling Valentine's. Ben is selling June 16th. Okay, very good. At least she waited until he was 18 before she forced him out of the house. That's nice of her. Crazy as the old bitch might have been, right?
That is nice.
Yeah. See, soft.
All right, let's do some sport, Ben. There's lots to talk about here.
So,
let's
guys, you know this, like, Test cricket, it's waning. It's got so many sort of bad things around it.
Well, you have been a cheerleader for saying that some of it is really dreary.
Of course it is, because who wants to watch Bangladesh versus, I don't know, Zimbabwe or whatever?
No one cares.
But when the best play against the best format is Test cricket.
Okay.
It's proven over and over and over, and this week at Lord's is the World Test Final Championship. Now, this game, it's been so ebb and flow, to and fro, back and forth, all those kind of things. But I think what it comes down to is that all the batsmen are completely undercooked. They've been playing T20 cricket. They haven't been spending a lot of time at the crease. So the bowlers are coming in and the wickets are just rolling here. The first day, like I said earlier, there was 14 wickets in the first day. And yes, the overhead conditions were helping, the pitch helps, all those kind of things. But cricket is actually so much more exciting when the bowlers are on top. And I know it's an unconventional sort of opinion because cricket's just become this absolute show and go run fest because apparently that's what people wanted. No, it's boring as shit.
They want people bowled out.
This test match has absolutely proven that when the bowlers are on top, we've got something that's really exciting. Okay. So South Africa won the toss. They decided to bowl. It went pretty well. They bowled the Aussies out for 212. Now, the average score at Lord's for the first innings is around 240, 250. Mm-hmm. So it got them out below that. But then they stood there shaking like shitting dogs, letting the Aussies bowl at them. Horrible game plan because they were on the back foot the whole time. They eventually got rolled up for 138. Okay. And then it was like, right, game over. No, our bowlers are great. With all those South Africans over there spinning 200 rand in a beer and getting shit-faced, the cheering, the singing, this game has been just an absolute joy to watch at Lord's, the home of cricket. So the Aussies are 144 for 8 at the start of day 3, which means that they lead by 218. So traditionally, day 3, day 4 are good batting days for the test match. If the sun's out, great. So will that be the case? Are our batsmen going to have the composure? I don't think so. I think 180 was the peak of what the batting team can get. Aussies are going to set maybe 230, 240, probably too far. But this entire game has been bonkers. It has been so fun to watch. And it just shows that the World Test Final is a really great thing in cricket. There's been so much banter around this. Like, Lord's is a sellout through, I think the first 4 days are sold out. No one goes to a fifth day because they sell them off 5th days. But yeah. So I think 10:30 SA time today, it's back on. Weather permitting, I think it's going to be a great day of batting. And if the Proteas can somehow take this deep, somehow, because you know this is for a trophy, right?
Yes. Mm.
We don't have ICC silverware. There was that Champions something in 98, but no one actually remembers that. No one cares about
nobody
that.
Nobody knows.
But this is a big deal, and it's a massive deal that our guys are showing tremendous heart in.
Azalea says that the groundskeeper at Lord's needs to come to the front of the class. What may Azalea be referring to?
Not in the slightest. No. Terrible take. No, the pitch is fine.
Oh, okay.
It's great. Those batsmen are all undercooked. The bowlers are fine because you're getting a rhythm going the whole time with bowling.
Mm.
Even Lungi Ngidi said yesterday, he was dog shit in the first innings, and he said he had no rhythm whatsoever. Came in yesterday, bowled brilliantly. It's a rhythm thing. Batsmen need time at the crease. You don't get that when you play white ball cricket. So that's why the scores are low. I don't think it's got to do with the fact that the bowling is, okay, the bowling is good. Pitch is fine. Okay. Batsmen are just underdone.
No excuses.
But they're underdone on both sides, so it's entertaining. And this is what Test cricket is going to be going forward. So be it.
Fantastic.
Talking of ultimate test, the US Open this week, the golf. So it's been played. Now, the great thing about the majors in golf is that the golf courses themselves become like the stars of the show. None more so than the US Open, because it's the toughest golf test in the world, the toughest golf courses. So Oakmont, where it's being played right now in Pennsylvania, this guy back in the early 1900s, he was diagnosed with something that was going to kill him. So he's like, okay, I'm selling my steel business. I'm going to make the world's most difficult golf course. And for the final days, before I die of this disease, I'm going to have this golf course and play. Turns out he was misdiagnosed. He got to live a long and fruitful life. And he dedicated the rest of those days to craft this golf course into the most difficult thing in the entire world.
Wow.
So in America, he wanted links golf course, no trees. Bunkers, slopes, greens that slope, everything will hurt you. And it is. It's the world's toughest golf course. But what also makes this golf course interesting is that it's the only one that's in tournament condition every single week of the year, basically. Sure, it snows and they have downtime. Because they're obsessed, Gareth.
They spend vast quantities of money.
Yes, huge amounts. But they're obsessed with this. Like, Augusta is like an Instagram model I've spoken about many times in the show. Mm. It's beautiful when you watch the Masters. It's basically, it's a
construction
site.
It's
a field. It's cuck. It's only like that for 2 months. Oakmont is like that all the time. So the rough, I don't know if you know too much about grass, but to make it really hard and like grabby, you got to keep mowing it and brushing it and raking it.
It's a very difficult thing to have a lawn.
So that's what they do at this place, right? The rough is so hectic. And every day they're raking it so that when the ball goes in, it grabs the ball. It doesn't just sit like this. Everything about this golf course is fucking nuts. It's so great. And because it wants to be the hardest in the world. Sure. So there's only 10 guys under par for the first round. Yeah. Par will be a great score. That's what the US Open is always about. JJ Spawn is leading with Tristan Lawrence in second place, currently at 3-under. JJ and 4-under. But yeah, Rory McIlroy, he was 2-under at the turn, finished +4, +3. Scottie Scheffler's in the same score, as is Bryson DeChambeau. The last two times it's been held at Oakmont, the two longest hitters on the week have won. So that was Angel Cabrera and then Dustin Johnson. It's going to be a fantastic weekend of that. It really is. It's on the East Coast as well, so the time difference isn't too bad.
Okay.
Just, it's golf at its absolute best. We've got test match cricket at its absolute best. We've got golf at its best. And then we've got Canadian Formula One, where McLaren's going to win.
Okay. And then you're also going to be recording a new episode on The Bounce today. We're talking about the URC Grand Final for the Lions Tour next weekend.
Yeah, so that's this week's episode on The Bounce, that Kota Nagani. So the URC Grand Final this weekend, that's the other big thing to watch. The Bulls versus Leinster at 6. Now, Leinster have been the Proteas of world rugby in that they choked the fuck out of it. But great team. And, you know, and like we spoke about on the show this week, is that when SA fans got into watching European rugby, everyone was blowing smoke up how great Leinster is. They're this amazing team. It's the Irish team. They're going to win everything. They've won nothing in the last three, four years. So I would like to have major energy around everyone reminding them of that big choke energy. The Bulls are without a few key players. They're going to be massive underdogs going into this one. But that's Saturday at 6. Next week, though, the actual British and Irish Lions series starts. So this week, coming up now, we're going to have a show with John Robbie. Unpacking all of this.
John Robbie coming to sit with you.
John's hugely passionate. He played in the Lions Tour.
Good stuff, Ben.
But the Lions Tour is seen as sport's greatest tour.
Yeah.
And we're going to
unpack why. He's the right
guy.
I mean, he knows. That's how we got to know John Robbie.
So John, quick history lesson again. John came to SA in 1980 to play on the Lions Tour. Mm-hmm. He came back with the Irish team in 81. Mm-hmm. And then just stayed.
Yeah.
Stayed.
He's become an absolute gentleman of the world of media and of sport.
And now he's working in history. So yeah, that's it for the weekend. Hey, incredible golf, incredible test match, which might not go past today. And then,
do you think the Proteas can actually take it?
I don't think they can. I don't think the batting lineup shows that they can do this, but everything is so set up, like the homeless guy, for the most amazing story, and I'm all for that. So yeah,
can we go from one sport to another? We love to look at people and criticize their appearance on this show, right? And we've made it a bit of a sport, especially on a Friday. We do. We put pictures up and we go, oh, look at that person.
More like you go,
I do.
look at this person.
I do. But I think, I mean, Ben has suggested we take a look at Liz Hurley.
Oh, who's that?
Have you got that picture?
Who's that?
Okay, I'll tell you who Liz Hurley is in a
second.
Who's
that?
Just have a look. It's almost better if she doesn't know. That's Liz Hurley.
She's gorgeous.
Yeah.
That woman is 60 years old.
6-0.
60. 60.
60. That woman is 60 years old. Okay, the background is Liz Hurley came to prominence as an actress. She was in a couple of movies.
Austin Powers.
She was the hottie in Austin Powers.
She would like to think she had bigger roles, but that was it.
Was she and Hugh Grant married, or were they just?
I think.
I don't know. Anyway, they were together for a long time. Then she was with Shane Warne for a little bit.
Yes.
She was with. She's been on the scene for a long time. Maybe because Britain doesn't have that many attractive women, she was the belle of the ball there for a good 2-3 decades even.
Yeah.
And, you know, she in her own right has been a successful model and actress, but she looks tremendous.
She looks gorgeous.
That's unbelievable for 60.
It really is.
Good Lord, God in heaven.
She looks like 37. 38.
Wow, she says, happy birthday to me.
Good 38.
This year has already been a wild ride. My 30th year of working with the Estee Lauder companies, 30th year as a global ambassador, blah, 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 breast cancer campaign, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, 60 years old and look at her. I mean, I'd listen to her talking shit about her Elizabeth.
Fire emojis are in her DMs.
What is she? Global ambassador for what? Estee Lauder. I'd listen to that. I'd put up with that. I'd say, yeah, I've got a 60-year-old girlfriend.
Yo, she's gorgeous.
Shit. Right?
She looks better than some of my age mates.
But like, what's her game, though? Like, is she into younger men? Because she's not, like, if you look like that, you got choice.
Oh, sure. I don't know what.
I mean, like, Madonna was, like, extracting the youth out of those Peruvian boys. But, I mean, that was more of, like, a longevity
Madonna
thing.
Madonna needs to retire. She doesn't look good for her age.
No, but Liz Hurley. And I know people can say, yeah, because she has a lot of work done. But, yeah, totally.
Isn't
but
it's how Carl you manage Santos, that. The small, hairy Portuguese man who keeps insulting you, Ben, says, I'd give one of my kids away for 30 minutes with Liz Hurley.
Yo.
Yes, some honesty. That's good, Carl. We appreciate that.
Spectacular. I wonder what these ladies are drinking. Like, we've seen some of these celebrities do it right, and then some of them do it wrong, like Kris Jenner, where she looks 20 years younger, but it doesn't look good. And then you see people like her and like Halle Berry. Like Halle Berry is like 40-something, but she looks absolutely...
Halle Berry's way much older than 40.
Yeah, like she's just aging.
And she looked good for a very long time.
Yes, and you just wonder, like, what are you drinking? What are you doing? Like, give me
it's
the secrets.
It's a plan. Halle Berry's 58.
She looks gorgeous. Yeah. She looks absolutely...
And I know we always give a shit, but J-Lo, I mean, the woman looks great.
You
know,
no, she does.
She's a horrible person, but she's great.
But she's...
She looks amazing.
Every day she chooses to be her best. That's the thing. You've got to keep choosing it. You can't just go, I'm looking all right at the moment.
Right.
You've got to choose the shit.
Well, there
we go.
Work
it is.
So, you know, we often are rude about people today.
No, today
all compliments.
Giving them the flowers.
For Liz Hurley. What a great ambassador. Ooh.
Compare her to Cardi B, okay?
Yeah.
Don't do that. Let's not get started. Ben, I don't want like us to, been, like, not be okay, okay?
In like, relative terms, she looks like she's just been scrumming with the spring
Ben, box. Ben, Cardi looks good. She's a young, hot mole.
I'm not saying she doesn't look good. It's just that she's like choosing
this. She's only 33, okay? You can't compare the two.
She's got all this angst and she's fighting about this and that stuff ages you.
No, but she's also from the hood. You can't compare.
Joseph
the
George
two.
Says,
she's gorgeous,
let's
man.
Google her and see other photos of her. Yeah, because maybe that's just a really good
photo. It is a really good photo, but that's another thing you do is that you got to have good photos.
Yes,
it's part of the whole story.
I mean, even if it's not like it's photoshopped to the nth degree, you could see the person. And if she looks half as good as she does in that picture, she's still...
But that's exactly why AI content stands out so much, because you can never replicate beauty.
Chomotso says the secret is to drink lots of water.
Stay hydrated, of course.
Yeah. Apparently, she's going out with Billy Ray Cyrus now.
Ah.
Wow.
Is she? Is that for real? Like Miley's dad? Don't tell my heart, my achy breaky. That guy? She's dating him? Mm. Oh, wow.
Okay. That might eat her.
All right. So that's good. Apparently,
see, look at her. That's
she looks amazing.
That's not Photoshop. That's her hanging out.
My God. I promise you, I know girls in their 20s and 30s who don't look this good.
At all. And she's 60. Heaven.
All right, so apparently Kylie Jenner's boyfriend has a list of demands. Oh. We don't know who this person is, do we? Is he famous?
He's an actor.
He's an actor. It was horrible if he was an actress.
Like, yeah, you know, in Hollywood, they identify as both.
So, all right, Kylie Jenner's boyfriend. You know, you would think for an actor, because there are no movie stars anymore. There used to be a time when movie stars were a thing. If you asked any kid who's your favorite movie star, they'd be able to say, you know, Tom Cruise, Sylvester Stallone, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Brad Pitt, whoever. They'd have a movie star in their minds.
Yes.
Now that's not a thing. Now it's a YouTuber or a Mr. Beast or whatever. Yeah. That's what kids will answer now. So if you're an actor now, you got to glom on to the Kardashians because they're probably a meal ticket for you. Mm-hmm. This guy has the nerve to suggest he has a list of demands from...
So this guy's... This guy's I don't know what his name is.
Do you got a picture of him? Timothy Chalamet. Okay, we know who he is. Okay. Timothy Chalamet is quite... He did Dune.
Oh, that dude. Is that him?
Yeah, so maybe he's in a position to... Okay. So, set some parameters.
But his whole thing is that he wants to be so far away from the Kardashians because he takes his career more seriously. As in, like, his demands are
that
he's not going to be on the show and he's not going to be on her Instagram.
Hard to tell those two apart at a distance. If it wasn't for the moustache, you'd think they might be the same person.
I think his demands are a little too late.
If they walk in and he doesn't have the moustache, it's a bit androgynous. They both could be interchangeable in every way.
She has a better jawline. But I think this guy's got a good strategy.
Here we go, being horrible about people again.
Kylie Jenner's hot, right? Like, she's super
hot. No, she is, absolutely.
So most guys will pander to that.
Yeah.
And this goes against many universal kind of
traits. So are you saying you respect him or you think he's a turd?
No, I think he's got a great game plan because no other guy is bringing this to the table with her. So she's like, oh, okay, I take him more seriously now because he doesn't want this.
No, I think this guy, now that we know it's Timothy Chalamet, he's on the up and up. He's a big deal in Hollywood at the moment. He's a very much in-demand actor for lots of different projects. Yeah. He can pick and choose. And he can afford to be picky and choosy about what the girlfriend does. I think they've both scored in this respect. They're probably the it couple of Hollywood at the moment. Mm. Good. Set some rules. Set some boundaries. Set some parameters.
Okay. So the reason
and
why
don't share too much on social media, you two.
Yeah.
Don't put your holiday pictures on there. Don't let people see your domestic disputes. Don't let people hear about how she's a bit upset because he looked at some other girl. Just keep it all to yourselves. Keep it as private as possible for as long as possible. People will be hungry for any information about you, and you can give them a little tidbit here or there. And otherwise, keep them the hell out of your business. That's how you'll keep the relationship.
But is this guy a bit of a relationship sort of genius in this respect, Sim? So, like, if he, I mean, is this some, I see you shaking, you don't seem to like this story much. But don't you think that this guy's got a good game plan? If a guy were to go into a relationship with you and say, like, I think this is going fantastically well, but here are my three steps. Take it or don't.
No. Because they still... So here's the thing about like him saying, oh, I don't want to be on the show. I don't want to be posted on the social media. But they go out to red carpet events together, right?
Yeah.
And they do the whole like basketball games. They're sitting there. They're taking pictures. So we still get a glimpse of the relationship that you're so trying to hide from us. We still see them together, all lovey-dovey. Oh, congratulations and stuff like that. So it defeats the whole purpose because he's doing exactly what he's saying he doesn't want to do, which is share his relationship with people.
I disagree. But I think those things you mentioned there are inevitable things of this, unless they're going to be Herberts.
Also, he's just doing it now because he's booked and busy. One thing the Kardashians have done very right is once you start falling off, they're going to put you on the show.
It's because they fall you off.
Like, no. They're going to be like, komiso, let me show you how it's done. And put you back on the map. So that's my thing, that right now he has options. But when those options are gone, best believe he'll be on the show.
But maybe he's just horrified by the family. And I mean, I wouldn't blame.
Never dated them in the first place. He's already cuckoos for going to the Kardashians and dating anyone of those.
I think they're horrible people.
Of course they are, but take her in isolation. She's super hot and maybe they get along, okay? So you'll indulge
a bit. The hotness will be the downfall of his career. Have you seen what these girls do to men?
It's the downfall of many men.
Have you seen what they do?
Back to the story of Samson. I mean, it's always going to be the fucking downfall. Okay, but second question here, because we know the inevitability of the Kardashian curse. Yes. If a guy was to say, like my first question, I think this is going great. In future, I would really like to date you, but these are the rules.
Hey, wasn't there some kind of a law about Kardashians only dating black guys? Haven't they broken that law now?
Yeah, but she's a half.
They have, right?
She's a Jenner, though.
Oh, but then she's half trans, not.
You see the slide started with the actress. All I'm saying.
Is she half trans if her dad is trans?
I don't know. It depends how they identify.
If your dad is black, your mum's white, then you're coloured in South Africa, you're mixed race in America. If your dad's a girl now, are you like half trans just because your dad is?
Interesting question for another show. Answer my original question, Sabir. You are skirting the issue here terribly. You're trying to take us down this murky path of Kardashianism. No. Answer my question.
Please repeat the question.
So if a guy meets you and things go well and he goes, look, I think this is going to go really well for us, but here are my three absolute steadfast rules.
Sure. But I'm saying in the case of the Kardashians.
Which we've already got through.
What I'm saying is that we've seen their history. We've seen what they do to men. We've seen that guys have, like Kanye West also started off with boundaries. And he also was like, and look how he turned out after the marriage.
They chewed him up and spat him out.
You know what I mean? So it's all
those
good and well.
Fucking Kardashians.
In the beginning to say, this is who I am. This is what I stand for.
Yes,
and these are my do's and don'ts.
You said this 5 minutes ago. I'm asking you.
And I'm saying, shout out to him, but I don't think it's going to last in the realm of the Kardashians and what they tend to do
to
men.
I'm with
and
those
careers.
Kardashians
seen
are
it.
Guys, I agreed with you about 5 minutes ago. Let's keep us going.
Women, yeah.
I agree with you five minutes ago.
I can't be like, oh, yay. No.
I think it's great that they set some parameters.
Yeah,
I think you have to go into...
It doesn't help if you walk into the lion's den.
You have to go into a relationship or a business or a friendship with your eyes wide open.
Yeah, but it doesn't help if you're going to the mushroom. All I'm saying is that it's all good and well for me to be like virtuous and say, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to do that. And then still go to the lion. It doesn't make sense. Like, if you're dating another girl, I'd be like, great, I respect this wholeheartedly. If it was me, I'd be like, yes, I respect you. Like, sir, let's...
All right. Kardashians,
no.
Yeah, just be very careful of those people. So, Simpiwe, apparently there's a story about a South African billionaire who gave his domestic workers a 1 million rand bonus.
Yes. Did you do that, Gareth?
I think I might. If you're a billionaire, you want to help people who are closest to you. And one of the people who I imagine for many people in South Africa is closest to them is their domestic worker. That person has intimate knowledge of your life. Yes. That person you trust with your house and your possessions and your pets and your children and all kinds of things. I think this is an important person to many people, including billionaires. But what I think is so important here is that billionaires get a very tough rap from people who are not billionaires. We always go, oh, well, you know, if they've got all this money, they must be greedy, selfish bastards. They're clearly only interested in profit. They don't do anything good for anyone else. This is not true, and it's not fair to billionaires because there are a lot of them who are doing more than the heavy lifting they have to do for their own lives. Often they are pulling the rest of humanity along with them.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to know which billionaire did this?
Damn right.
It's the one and only... The first African to make it into space? Mark
Shuttleworth.
Yes.
Wow.
So the story is, and I think it happened a while back, but it only got like published recently, is that he's also like this tech genius entrepreneur. And so he sold one of his companies for like billions. Right? And he decided, you know what? I'm going to do a good thing and give all the employees in his companies, but also including 57 of his, like, helpers, Like, yeah, that's the gardener, the cleaner. They all got R1 million as a bonus to say thank
beautiful.
You for
I think that's lovely.
Your hard work good. And contributing to the company for making it a success.
He did that from day one with his very first success. He was doing that with his staff.
Love it. Like, so yeah, I recently saw that and I was like, oh my gosh, like, this is such a beautiful, kind deed. And the whole thing was like, they also contributed to the success of the company, so they must also reap the benefits when he sells it for billions of rands.
Sure. Absolutely right. I think many of us who are not billionaires would like to, if we had lots and lots of money, and frankly, I mean, I don't think you need to have lots of money to do good things. It's just much easier if you do. You can make a bigger difference in people's lives. But I've paid some other people's bills. I've done a couple of things that I could, where I could. People have asked me to help them out, and I have. And sometimes you regret it because you don't know that that person lives up to anything that you hoped they would afterwards. Yes. But sometimes you just do it for the giving. Sometimes it's not about what it results in, whether they change their life, whether it saves their business, whatever. Sometimes you just do it because you want to do it. And I think Mark Shuttleworth is a terrific example of somebody who knows that money needs to flow. It doesn't, you can't dam it up.
Yeah.
You have to keep it moving. And if you are generous and you are kind, then kindness and generosity come back to you. Certainly, that's the theory, right? And let's hope
it's a wonderful theory
itself. Okay, any last-minute things you two want to throw in? Because I've got two guests who are waiting to come and tell us about their
exciting lives. I'll just throw in that I'm excited for this long weekend.
Oh, good. Now that you've just discovered it's a long weekend.
I'm excited so much of this. And today
Ben had no idea. He arrived here this morning going, oh, it's Friday. Okay, nice. We've got Saturday and Sunday. But yeah, no, you've also
watched the golf until the end. I can go to gym again. Huh. I can do all these things. I'm back to normal life.
Oh, right, because of the hair thing.
Yeah, as of today, I can go play golf again.
Oh, you can do all the normal stuff.
Yeah.
Have you been feeling like you were a little bit depressed and sad about not being able to do any physical exercise?
Yeah, that it hits me hard all the time. Yeah. But I've just found ways of dealing with it better and therefore a lot less cunty. And here I am. Look at me.
Well, you've been a bit cunty about the Kardashian thing.
No, I haven't.
Right, Simpiwe? Cunty about Cardi B this morning.
I've been an absolute delight this morning.
Yeah.
But you were very complimentary about Liz Hurley.
Mm. Yes.
I mean, who wouldn't? How hard is it to be complimentary about Liz Hurley? Really? All right. Thank you. Thank you, Ben and Simpiwe.
Bye, guys.
All right. It's fine. Walk in front of the cameras. We're not professional here. Okay. So, Alex van Heerfer and Reneas Mhlongo, who are South Africa's most remarkable tracking partners. These guys, it's an amazing story. It began as a relationship shaped by vastly different backgrounds. It's grown into a deep bond that is rooted in wildlife, in tracking. They build educational programs, safari experiences. They've co-authored celebrated books. And they continue to inspire global audiences with a powerful message of trust, of cultural understanding, and of humanity's enduring connection to the natural world. So I'm thrilled to have both Alex and Reneas here in the studio with us today. You can find them online at Kruger Untamed is the handle. That's at Kruger, as in the Kruger Park. Untamed, Untamed. Gentlemen, nice to have you here.
Thank you so much, Gareth. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for coming. So did you have to travel far? Did you come from Mpumalanga or are you here on some other business as well?
No, we came from Mpumalanga and we go back right now, straight off
sure.
the show.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. Never stops, huh?
Yeah, yeah. No, we've got a group at Londolozi.
What a place.
Yeah.
Very, very special. Yes. So how did you two meet? Because I've been to the bush a couple of times and I've met some of the characters who are involved in both of the things that you two do. And I've sometimes thought to myself, I wonder what their life is like when we're not there as tourists, as paying people on holidays or on an experience. And I often wonder about the relationships between people who work in such sometimes quite isolated places and in such close proximity. It's such an interesting contrast.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was a 19-year-old young game ranger and I arrived at Londolozi as a trainee guide. And ultimately became qualified to take guests out on safaris and was allocated Reneas as quote-unquote my tracker. He's 13 years older than me. He'd been there for 12 or 13 years before I arrived. So we literally got thrown together. We had no choice in each other's assignment.
Right.
And it's been a 30-year relationship and journey. Wow. We've walked together since then.
I mean, most people can't pull off a 30-day marriage or relationship in the city. You guys have been friends now for that long. So, I mean, you speak mostly Shangaan, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
What did you think when you first met this guy?
So he thought I was just another young white person that come to work. but you know, this had happened. I was the 12th or 13th ranger that Ren was about to work with when I arrived.
Yeah, so he'd met lots of people before. By the way, how long did it take you to pick up all the Shangaan?
Probably 10 years properly.
Sure.
Yeah.
And now you're pretty fluent.
Yes, I'm conversationally good.
Okay.
I'm solid, yeah. In the beginning, Renius could speak no English and me no Shangaan. So there was a lot of sign languages involved, a little bit of Fana galore, which is a language I really don't like. And but Ren was amazing. He would just speak Shangaan to me. And I remember being so frustrated in the bush. He'd be seeing stuff and he'd be telling me, but I couldn't understand it. And it got better and better. And I do remember a day down in Adonga and him talking about what he was seeing, and I could understand. I thought, this is incredible. I've entered the life of a man that I'd, you know, I was able to access his beliefs, his ideas in a way that I hadn't been before.
It's amazing how, you know, we're a country of diverse languages and we've got so many official languages, but a lot of people don't get to communicate it at any deep and meaningful level. It's sometimes quite superficial. It's like just basic understanding. And I don't think you can do that in the bush because there's serious things you need to pay attention to. Before you came along, though, how long had Rinias been working, and how did he start off in that kind of world of tracking and animals?
So he started off, he was born in what is today the Greater Kruger National Park. His job as a young boy was to look after his father's cattle and goats and to hunt small game. They were effectively hunter-gatherers. And in 1984, he started as a tracker and thereby was able to realize his incredible... It was because it came... Vati tells me that it wasn't soon after Renia started that... What he saw in Ren, his ability to find animals, to make sense of the environment, and his ability with people was just exceptional. And that was 40 years ago.
Yeah, it's amazing. People think that trackers and guys like you who work in the bush, you only have to be good at spotting animals, knowing how nature works, which tree you can and can't eat the leaves off of, what you can learn from this worm. But it's people as well, because you have to deal with all kinds of people from all over the world, some of whom have a deep and abiding curiosity, and some who are just absolutely the most vapid people imaginable, who, you know, have been given this trip and they don't really care whether they're here, there, or anywhere. And you have to very quickly assess these things and figure out a way of dealing with them.
No, that's right, Gareth. And it's an industry that chews people up and spits them out quickly. The average guide turnover at the average lodge is, I don't know, 2 years. Because
sure.
It's an interesting mix. You come in, usually it's people who are interested in animals and wildlife, or they are interested in people, but often not both. And then you get asked to take game drives starting at 5 a.m. You're with people all day, and then invariably late into the night, and there's alcohol involved.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, people get worn down. So there's this whole idea of energy. We always say that good guides have good energy, but if you can stay healthy and not imbibe too much in the alcohol, and have a good relationship with the person you're working with, you can stay. And we always knew we were going to make a career of this. This was not a ski job for us, where it is mostly for a lot of other guys. Yeah.
what do you think Grenius's greatest skill is? Because these things are developed over time, and then maybe he can tell us what he thinks yours is.
Yeah. So from a tracking perspective, what I've seen in Ren, so tracking, broadly speaking, when you look at the art and science of tracking, it requires two modes of thinking. The one is a very focused, analytical, rational side of the mind. You've got to be able to tell whether a track is fresh. You've got to be able to make differences. You look at the minutiae. Then you've got to be able to move across and see, be more holistic and more creative. You start to ask questions like, what is this animal doing? Where is it going? And trackers...
And storytelling.
And, well, right. It's totally storytelling. It's using evidence to tell stories about what the animal is doing, where it's going, and then form a hypothesis and then go and test that hypothesis. The best trackers in the world, most trackers are either one or the other. They're more focused, systematic, or they're more creative. But you need the one to have the other work. And that's where Ren is so good. He's able to move between the detail and the art and the big picture. He moves seamlessly between those two very disparate modes of thinking. And that's what makes him incredible.
Ask him what he thinks it is about you.
Alex. Kuze namuntlha kuma hi ri vambirhi i tikomba a ri munhu loyi a kota ku a lava ku navela ku ta funda ku u nga landzisa ku yini ene a ri munhu loyi a karhi a bukabuka titele ku komba i la ta funda swaku funda a tracka se hi yo mhaka mina yehe ivi hi hlanganile vixe xin'we because a ni vona ku ri energy a hi vambirhi yi teka ndhawu yin'we strong ta kota ku ta swibye emahlweni.
So he thinks that my strength is my detail. And that I push to learn. And Ren's got a big picture kind of bent to him. And he thinks the reason we're good together is that I take care of the detail and he takes care of the holistic
that's
stuff.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Have you
something
else?
It might not have done over. Said, don't ask Alex Garlua. So, okay, it's like an account. And the Chilean and the men in Galeo. It's a much.
The 13 rangers he'd worked with before I arrived, none of them had taken any interest in the tracking on his side of the work, his language, his culture. But when I arrived, he saw somebody who was interested. And that was what set the spark. So, like, we can
interested is interesting, right? Yeah. Why should you make an effort with someone who's patently not interested in you? And it must be, for many people, they have an idea of what it is to be in the environment you two are in and to be doing the jobs that you two do. And they could be very, very wrong. They get this romantic idea of, oh, I could be a game ranger, I could be a tracker, I could live in the wild, I could, you know, stay at this amazing lodge, this very tight-knit community of people who work together every day. Can go out there into the bush. Every day is an adventure. It's not like that all the time. There's a lot of real slogging, right?
Yeah, totally. I mean, the hours are incredibly long. Oh. You're in the hot sun. You're getting stung by, you're getting bitten by mozzies at night. It's hot. if you're lucky, you sleep in a place with an air conditioner. Mostly you don't. A canvas tent is 50 degrees in the day and 5 at night. So, lodges these days, places like the more established, well-known lodges are much better now at looking after their staff. There's much more focus in staff welfare, their nutrition, where they live, the terms of their employment. So people are staying longer. But in the 90s, you slept wherever you could find a level place to be.
So obviously Ren comes from a generation, perhaps one of the last ones, who does traditional tracking, right? And this is a skill which has become outdated in many places. Unless you work in a job like he does, it's probably not something you need to remember anymore. You know, there's so many cultural artifacts, things that society's moved on from. I mean, I think just in terms of my life, people's handwriting is deteriorated. We don't write letters to each other anymore. And is traditional tracking like that? Is it something that's become increasingly rare and is not handed down from the wise elders like him who learnt from wise elders before him.
That is exactly right, Gareth. The worldwide trend of rapid urbanization has affected tracking. People have just moved from rural areas into cities, meaning less people track. This was also the effects of the apartheid regime and the forced removals, of which Wren was his
when
family
they made
lost.
The Kruger Park, right?
Yeah, yeah. He was asked to leave his area where he grew up. And so there are less and less people doing it. But what we have found, especially recently, is the value of tracking in conservation, protecting rhino. We are seeing it now. The parks who no longer have traditional trackers are being hammered by poaching. Mm. It's as simple as that. Because the poachers usually come from rural areas, and they're highly motivated, and they're skilled in the bush. And so they're running rings around our anti-poaching personnel. The people tasked with protecting rhino do not have the skills that they had in the 80s and 90s. And we are seeing this with our work with Tracker Academy. And now we are working with Kruger, with other parks, to retrain their field rangers specifically in the art of tracking and man tracking. And so there's a clear example of, although it's an ancient craft, it still has real tangible value.
Do you sometimes find yourself just stunned and amazed when Wren pulls some completely bizarre and arcane knowledge out of the bag and shows you something that you otherwise would have missed yourself?
Yeah, I mean, it happened the other day with a python. It was quite the other day. It was recently, though. We were standing around, we'd been tracking a leopard. We found it. We came back to the vehicle. We were having a cup of coffee. We were with our Tracker Academy students, and some birds started alarming in the bush 50 meters away. And Wren casually, he's holding his coffee mug, he says, casually says, "There's a python there." So one of the students says, "It's a snake." He said, "No, yes, but it's a python snake." I said, "How do you know that?" He said, "Come, let's go and look." And so he walked with his coffee mug and he walked around the bush towards, and lo and behold, there was a smallish, it was a 2 meter python there. And like we asked, like, "How did you know it was a python?" Well, yes, you can tell from bird alarm calls if it's a snake. I mean, even that's a stretch, but yes. But how did he know? And maybe Wren, you want to tell why you knew it was a python.
I get a punch log in Basso. See, did you from the sea? I get a punch log.
So, what he's saying is that the python moves slowly, it moves along the ground, it has no ability to strike up, it doesn't go into trees that much. And the way the birds were moving low to the ground, the cadence and the sort of urgency of their calls indicated such that it was a python.
It's amazing. Ask him for me what the most difficult animal is to track and which animal he finds easiest to identify from like miles away.
So saying the leopard is the hardest to track by far.
Really?
A lion, for example, moves in predictable straight-ish directions. A leopard is much more mercurial. It's investigating and moves in unpredictable. You have to be very technical. You have to have incredibly refined ability to see the animal's track.
Well, how amazing, because that's always the animal that everyone wants to see, right? If you spot a leopard, you think you've won the lotto of game drives and game viewing.
Yeah, totally. And we've researched this. On average, an average competent tracker working in an area where they track leopards every day are finding leopards where they get off the vehicle with a fresh spoor, follow and find that animal. They're only around 20% successful, 20% of the time.
Really?
Yeah. Wren in his heyday was in his 60s. There was a guy called Richard Sewela at Londolozi who was in excess of 70%, but he was an anomaly. He was the best tracker we both agree, the best leopard tracker probably in Africa. Probably
in the world.
And then, yeah, exactly. Mm. Tracked more leopards than anyone else, had an incredible strike rate. But Richard was very interesting. Richard was very systematic. He had an ability to see the most unbelievable obscurities on the ground. And he had incredible patience. And he knew how leopards moved. The best leopard trackers in the world know most about leopards.
So how long can you guys keep doing this? You mentioned retirement and, you know, people being in their prime. And are you too old now, either of you? How long can you keep doing this? Because you clearly love it. You're clearly good at it. People love what you do. They love learning from you and being in your company while they learn these things. Is this the sort of job that you can keep doing?
Ren's saying
he's not going to leave this job.
Oh, good. Good,
and
good.
That as long as he can move, he's going to track. Of course, your eyes play an important role. As soon as your eyes start to go, it becomes really hard. Sure. And Ren doesn't look like it, but he's 60. You were talking about Liz Hurley earlier.
Yeah.
Ren's 63.
Amazing. And still doing it like never before. Unbelievable. It must be kind of scary sometimes, you say, when your eyes are going. But if you're out at dusk and you're not paying very careful attention, even when they're not other people you have to be responsible for, you are in the wild. I mean, you must have had some close encounters, both of you.
Yeah, no, we've had several. The one I always tell people about very briefly, Ren and I had been together 3 months. We were still in a very, very early phase where I didn't know what was going on. I'd been through training. I thought I was the all-knowing, all-seeing ranger. Within days, I realized that Ren was going to hold us together and keep us safe. And we got the first time he ever took me on foot. We were with a Canadian group. We left them in the car. They were seriously keen to see a leopard at Londolozi. We went off on foot. And what he didn't tell me was we were tracking the most dangerous leopard that was there at that time, the Tugwan female. And she was a schizophrenic. Some days she was totally calm. Other days she'd come at you. Sure. We once had her charge the car so badly that guests vomited off the side of the Land Rover. She had an ability to deliver a force of energy that was just unparalleled. Anyhow, we track this leopard down the dong. I don't know it's her. And she comes out of the bush at me, on my side. I've got the rifle. Ren's to the left. He's looking down. He tells me, look in the bush. If we find this animal, you must spot her. We don't want to get too close to her. And we get to this log. I step on this log. This animal launches itself at me. I try and step back. I should have stayed where I was and perhaps chambered around. But I take a couple of steps back, and I trip over that log.
Oh, shit.
I land on my back. And this animal comes over me like this. And my rifle is smashed out of reach. And she's right over me. I can smell her breath. Sand hit me in the shins as she stopped like this. Because now we're in a sandy donga. And long story short, Ren extracts us out safely. And
how?
So he says to me, the first thing he said to me, "Hey, Majomban, Hima." He used to call me Majomban, means small boots. He says to me, "Hima, wait." I thought, I'm standing there, I'm pinned by this animal. I thought, I'm not going anywhere. Then he says to me, "Nunga buka anti," please, don't look in the eyes. And I look down, and this makes it better. And she starts to calm. And then he says, "Okay, come back slowly." And as I start to move back, she comes at me again, and I stop. And he says, "Hey, come back, move slowly." And I start to move, and I realize I'm in no position to start negotiating, so I slowly move back.
Jesus.
And eventually she calms, and she goes, and what we realize is she's got these 2-3-month-old little cubs in the bush.
Okay.
And all she was doing was telling us to, in get leopard out. Language, to get away.
Yeah, I mean, she would have killed you if she wanted to eat you.
Yeah, 100%. Mm. This is the thing with animals, the predators. If they want to eat you, which they do not, we do not form part of their prey list. They would stalk. You wouldn't know that they're there.
Yeah.
It'd be one moment you're there, and the next they would have knocked you over, and you'd be unconscious, mostly broken neck or something.
Jeez.
A leopard doesn't charge you, and then it's telling you.
What about stories he's had when he's had these very close encounters? Maybe when you have or haven't been around.
Yeah, is there anything?
Kagaing beli asuria. I lo dung tukang abok mati lo ku usub buka so. He says
he's had too many encounters to tell you one story, but what he always says is that when you have an animal, especially a leopard or a lion, that's so close, you got to look down, you got to avoid icon. The moment you look at it, you're telling it, I'm here to fight too.
Oh, really?
Yes. Mm. And you're confronting it, and so you got to give the impression that you're submitting.
Yeah.
And then you slowly back. You also don't want to get up and run away because its instincts are kicking in and it'll chase you. So you got to tell it. I'm not afraid of you, but I'm submitting. And now I'm going to give you your space.
Jeez, in what that a balance! Order. What a delicate balance! My God. So tell us quickly, because you two you mentioned it briefly in passing just now, the Tracker Academy. I know so many people who go, I have this dream to do what you guys get to do every day. And maybe there are young people watching now, and this is all they've ever wanted. Now there is such a thing as a Tracker Academy. How does it work? How do you get in? What do you guys do with this Tracker Academy? And what do we need to know about it?
Yeah, thanks, Gareth, for giving us the opportunity to talk about this. It's where our soul work rests, really. It's in 2009, we resigned from our jobs at Londolozi. We went into the chilly wind of unemployment with this dream to create more Reniuses. Because of what I was telling you earlier. And we went to America because we told that's where all the money was. We traveled around there looking to raise funds for an idea to start a tracker training school in South Africa. We spent a year, we were teaching people to track bears and wolves and grizzlies and so on in America, hoping to raise money. We arrived back in South Africa in the November without a dollar to show for our efforts. People wanted to love to hear our stories of nearly dying.
Yeah.
But not, and on the beach in Plettenberg Bay, back in my hometown, I was days away from telling Ren we was going to get our jobs back at Londolozi. Long story short, I meet Gaynor Rupert, and she agreed, her and her foundation agreed to fund and found Tracker Academy. And so in 2010, we opened the doors to this tracking school.
She's a terrific human being, you know, people. Everybody knows Johan Rupert, everybody knows the family story, but Gaynor is a force of nature on her own. I mean, the things she's done in the world of horses, the things she's done in the world of wildlife, and now I hear about this, I'm very impressed.
No, Gareth, she's an incredible human being, the most gracious person you will not meet, a visionary in her own right. And
yes, absolutely.
And we could not have... As a result of her efforts and her influence, Tracker Academy has trained 320 young men and women, all unemployed, many without hope.
Do they listen to you, Reniuses?
Yes.
They listen to you?
Yes.
They better. They better, or they'll get eaten by leopards.
And what's important, Gareth, is 96% of anyone who's gone through Tracker Academy are now in permanent conservation jobs. They're building houses for
their
families.
That's phenomenal.
They're sending their kids to proper schools. So we're using tracking as a vehicle with which to do social good.
Wow, I think that's really a super story, and the kind of thing that's extremely inspirational for so many of us who care about this stuff, whether it's because we get to experience a small slice of it, or because we know it's part of the great wealth and enormous richness that we have as a part of our legacy in this country. The work that humans and animals do together, and that humans can do for humans in making the world better for the animals. And, you know, you guys are just doing incredible stuff, so I cannot thank you enough. What do you think the next generation of trackers will carry forward? And maybe both of you can answer this.
I'm not sure if you're a man.
What
he's saying is that trekking cannot die. It's our heritage, an African heritage, born in this country, on this continent. And it doesn't take much to get people interested in trekking, African people, especially rural people. It's part of their culture historically. And it's an African solution to an African problem. And we need to ensure that these trackers are not only technically competent, but also have the heart and the minds to go and be part of the solution in terms of saving rhino, protecting rhino, playing a meaningful role in ecotourism. And so Ren is very big on not only can we teach him to be exceptional trackers, but teaching him to be exceptional human beings and being the best versions of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he's putting a lot of time into is really, because we only work with small groups. We do 32 a year. We get 3,000 or 4,000 applications a year. Yeah. And so we really want to make sure that those who get our certificate, they actually go make a material change to the conservation.
Well done for doing this. Just one quick question here from Dirk, which I think is important. It will be interesting to know how AI and drones will affect tracking skills in the future. Do you guys see an upsurge in technological solutions to problems that used to be people-based and people-led and people-solved?
We haven't seen it yet, AI, but we are working on our own AI project. We've developed a mobile app in partnership with Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, HPE. Mm-hmm. And we are busy training the app to identify tracks. Now, tracking, there are two, broadly speaking, two components. The one is the identification of an animal's footprint. And AI will be able to do that quite soon. Even though it is a kudu's track, for example, can look very different depending on how it stepped on, you know, in
and
what
of course,
substrate,
what the substrate it is. It,
totally.
Know?
So yeah. It's not like there are apps that can identify trees by looking at the leaves. This is a few clicks more difficult. But then the other component is what we've been talking about, the following of a leopard.
Yeah.
AI is not anywhere close to being able to do that or follow a human being through the grassland that walked 2 days ago. AI is nowhere near. And I'm sure one day, possibly, yes, but right now there's no signs of that AI can do.
Because no one can replace what you guys do. Listen, it's a pleasure, and thank you for coming in this morning, and good luck with your trip back and a busy weekend, I'm sure, a long weekend in the bush. Alex van Heerfer and Renia Simhlongo, pleasure to have you here.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
All right, and we will be back on, not Monday, because Monday's a holiday, Wednesday, 6 a.m., bright and early. Cheers.